The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone. The topic I would like to address today is one that is often strongly identified with Buddhism by many people, and that is the topic of not-self, sometimes called no-self. And it's strongly identified with it, with Buddhism, often, and some people are quite perplexed by this teaching. Some people are irritated by it. You know, what does this mean? And it doesn't make any sense. And I think there are some reason, good reasons to be put off by the way it's taught sometimes. And there's a historical growth in how the teachings of no self, not self, anatta has developed over the centuries. And some of them are not so close to how the Buddha taught in the ancient world. Some of the ways they developed into the modern world was in reaction against other religious beliefs of the times. And so, for example, in Sri Lanka, they had to contend for many centuries with Christian missionaries. And so the teachings of anatta became very central as part of the enterprise of distinguishing themselves against Christianity. And so they kind of the emphasis on no self, very kind of almost dogmatically, was basically kind of a no soul teaching. And then we come to the modern West, and there's a very strong tendency for Western Dharma teachers to take a psychological interpretation or understanding of this anatta, no self teaching. And so then we grapple with Western psychological meanings of what it means to have a self and what do these Buddhists mean? What do the Buddhists mean? So I'd like to take you back, if I may, to the ancient world of the time of the Buddha to help you, help maybe try to explain a little bit how these important teachings were held back then, and start with a story. Soon after the Buddha was awakened, I don't know how long after, but relatively soon, he was resting or meditating in a park. I think kind of maybe a royal park or a park in the capital city where he was staying. And there were some young noblemen and noblewomen. And the text seemed to kind of depict them as dandies. And they came to the park to just enjoy themselves. And most of the noble men and noble women came with their spouse. But there was one nobleman who came with a courtesan. And so they did what young people do in parks, whatever they did back then. And at some point, they took a nap. And when they woke up from the nap, the courtesan was gone. And so was all the jewelry from the noblemen. These dandies had all this jewelry. And so, you know, they were concerned. They wanted their jewelry back. They figured that the courtesan who disappeared must have taken them. So they went searching through the park for the courtesan. And then they came across the Buddha meditating under a tree. So they came up to the Buddha and said to him, "Have you seen a woman?" And the Buddha said, "What would you rather find, a woman or yourself?" And as the story is told, this got the attention of these young noble men and women, that they sat down to hear what the Buddha had to say. And some of them then became his disciple. So what would you rather find? A spouse, a partner, or you know something, or do you want to find yourself? And I think the implication of this is that the Buddha felt it was more important to find yourself. And this is one of the great tasks of a human life, is to discover who we are, to become ourselves in a sense. And as some of you know, that one of the great spiritual questions is, you know, who am I? To discover who that is. And people who take this kind of question and exploration seriously are just confused when they come to Buddhism and say, oh, there is no self. Just give up that search. It's misguided. Because it seems so central to what we're all about. It also can be seen, this no-self idea, as it's put forward, somewhat disrespectful of ourselves. And this, we you know, and this is certainly not the case in the way the Buddha presented his teachings, which I would argue did it with tremendous respect for each person and the value, the worth of each person. The one of the ways I like to see this is in when the Buddha told kind of a parable of kind of how he discovered the path of practice and how he offered it to others. And the parable is, he says, there was a person who worked in the woods, and maybe gathering wood or something, who went into the woods one day, and in the woods discovered in the shrubs and overgrowth areas of the jungle evidence of an ancient path and or road, and kind of cleared the shrubs and see if actually there's a well-made road, maybe a nice brick road or something that was covered by debris and stuff, and then followed this road that was barely visible deep into the woods, and lo and behold, deep in the woods found a great capital, a great palace, ancient palace that had been long forgotten, overgrown. As they do to this day, they're finding Mayan capitals and cities in Central America that are amazingly big. You know, people are surprised by this, what they find. And so this person then came out of the woods and went to the local king and queen and said, I found an ancient palace, ancient capital in the woods. And so the king and queen gathered people up and they kind of cleared the road and marched along this ancient road and re-inhabited the old palace. And just in the same way, this Buddha explains the parable, I have discovered a path, an ancient path that's long overgrown. I didn't invent it. It's always been there. But like the woods person, I have, I point out where it is, and now it's your job to clear it, O kings and queens. And so the idea that through the parable that we're being, you know, our kind of position in the parable, what represents us in the parable, is the king and the queen. Right? To me, that indicates certain respect, nobility of seeing how other people are. And so there's that. And then there's another kind of metaphor that's used for the path of practice. And the path of practice, the Eightfold Path, for example, the path of practice that is that of a chariot. And not just any old chariot, but a war chariot. And here the analogy to being a person on this war chariot is being a soldier ready for battle. Perhaps an unfortunate metaphor, and I know many people, like I'm kind of reluctant to, you know, present a kind of macho, warlike metaphor for the human practitioner, for those practicing. But some people find it very meaningful, and again, very dignified in a sort of power and value, that the practitioner is likened to a warrior. And that you put on armor to, you know. So it's Mahatma Gandhi used the same kind of metaphor. Talked about a soldier for peace. So here it is. And here the vehicle, this chariot, is called a divine vehicle. or a Brahmayana. This is before the Mahayana or the Hinayana was invented, these terms. Back in the time of the Buddha, they called it, he called his path the divine vehicle. He says, this divine vehicle is unsurpassed and it originates from within oneself. Isn't that nice? So, you know, that's where the woods are. You have to clear the, you know. Anyway, the divine vehicle. So here, the qualities of this vehicle are faith and wisdom, which are always yoked evenly together. Kind of like a chariot with two horses, maybe, yoked together. Faith and wisdom. Shame, or conscience. Conscience is its pole. The mind is the yoke tie. Mindfulness, the watchful charioteer. The chariot's ornament is virtue. Its axle is concentration. Energy is its wheels. Equanimity keeps the burden balanced. Free of desire serves as the upholstery. Goodwill, harmlessness, are the chariot's weaponry. Isn't that nice? Harmlessness is your weapon? Forbearance, its armor and shield, as it rolls towards security from bondage. The wise depart on this vehicle, inevitably winning the victory. So, for whatever the no self teaching means, not self teaching means, here again we have this example of a practitioner not becoming self effacing and not counting, being nobody, but we actually have someone who is a warrior, is a dignified warrior, a powerful person on this chariot with these great qualities like weaponry. So this is kind of like in the worldview of the ancient time, this is kind of the context for the teachings of not-self. So this is part of it. So you can't deny this. You know, you have to remember this, hold it there. And so because of this, and I think it's useful to look at how the Buddha understands what it means to be a person. Before we go into what is self and not-self, what's this understanding of personhood in this ancient world? What does it mean? What is a humanness like? So there's a few things we can kind of pull out. One is that a person is someone who is capable of experiencing happiness and suffering, happiness and unhappiness. A person is possible to experience integration and disintegration. It's possible to experience wholeness or integrity. It's possible to experience disintegrity. Or a person is possible to be in bondage, the language of the ancient world, or freedom. We often use language of freedom for Buddhism in the modern world, but we tend to avoid the other half of it, that it's the contrast of it, bondage. Or in the ancient world, they sometimes talked about slavery. So being in bondage to your attachments, enslaved by them. A person is a moral agent, has agency. The person is someone who can do things that have consequence. That a person can have can through their choices and their actions can make a difference for their welfare, for their well-being, for their happiness and the suffering. Maybe this is obvious to many people in the West, this is the case, but in the ancient world it wasn't so obvious to people, where sometimes the idea was that the gods were the ones in charge and you had to kind of pray to the gods or make sacrifice to the gods and then maybe you could be happy, or that there was nothing you could do. That sense of a personhood is that there's a continuity of the cause and effect stream that the human being's involved in. That what the person does has consequences that that carries with us into the next day, in the next month, the next year, and in classic Buddhism, into the next lifetime as well. So that if you do acts of generosity, those practice of generosity condition a habit or condition us in some ways. And that conditioning and that impact of that generosity has a very different effect on our ongoing welfare than if you were miserly. Miserly conditions us a different way. And so a human personhood is someone who has continuity through time, in a certain kind of way. There's a part of a stream of cause and effect. And that we can participate in this stream through our choices about what intentions we have, actions that we live by. And then finally, the Buddha had the idea that some choices that the individual can make are more worthwhile than other choices. So it's more worthwhile choosing to be generous than miserly. It's more worthwhile to be kind and friendly than it is to be hateful or spiteful. It's more worthwhile to do the actions which lead to freedom than those actions that keep us enslaved or bring us to be enslaved, caught in attachments and all that. So since these are kind of some of the very general ideas of a person. These, you know, that somehow the ancient world, the Buddha, kind of held. These are not being denied. Whatever that anatta, the not self teaching is. So in summary, I'd like to say that so there's a certain valuing and worthfulness of the human being, of the individual, for each of you, certain dignity in which kind of you're viewed, and you're viewed in a way that you have some ability to choose your life in ways that are important and make a difference. Perhaps not in external ways of your life, but you have certainly ability to choose how you respond, your inner mental, emotional response, you have some agency over, not automatically in all ways, but you can develop yourself, you can cultivate yourself. In fact, the ancient world, in teaching the Buddha talked about people who had a developed self. There's people who have an undeveloped self, and there's no inner strength and development and discipline, but you can actually develop yourself slowly over time. And the idea of a slowly developing yourself slowly over time, becoming stronger in certain qualities and capacities, is part of this idea of personhood in the ancient world. You following me enough? We're there? Okay. So then we come to this teachings of not-self. Some of it was clearly in contrast to teachings in the ancient world that are likened to our, maybe, word soul. That there was, the ancient world had a certain, some people had an idea of some kind of eternal and unchanging soul that continued beyond our death. And the Buddha pointed out, for him, that there's no way of proving such a soul. There's no way to find and see such an idea. And because it couldn't be proven or seen, he felt it wasn't really useful for the purposes of becoming spiritually free. And so he just put it aside, is the impression I get. But he talked about not-self in other ways. And I think this is maybe an example that maybe gets you into the territory of what the possibility, the potential he's pointing to. So imagine yourself in a situation where you feel really at home. Maybe you're at home, or maybe you're in a natural setting, or someplace where you don't have to be anything for anybody. You don't have to prove yourself, you don't have to take care of anybody, you don't have to worry about how people see you. Maybe you're completely at home, just completely at peace and being yourself. You're so at home and just at ease and enjoying yourself that you have absolutely no thoughts about who you are in relationship to anybody else. And you're pretty peaceful. You're relaxed, you had a good nap, maybe you had a good meditation, maybe both. And you're just sitting there, maybe on your nice chair, having tea, looking out the window, as they say, being nobody, doing nothing, going nowhere, just content, just alive is enough, just content, peaceful, open. And then someone knocks on your door. Someone comes up. And so you watch your mind. What happens to your mind as the door gets knocked on? You see that in subtle ways, your mind begins to contract or get focused or get a little bit worried or concerned. Or in subtle ways, the mind contracts around, maybe you look around your apartment and say, you know, it's a little bit messy. I don't want someone to see me as a messy person. And so the mind, you watch the mind get a little bit contracted around an idea, an image of who you are, who you don't want to be, how you don't want to be seen. So that from the Buddhist point of view, or the practice point of view, that what's interesting here is the contrast between the mind that was peaceful and open and not concerned with self at all before the knock, and the contraction, the tightness, the stress that comes up, maybe a very, very subtle concern that comes up when we start, when the ideas of self and who I am and how people are going to see me come into play. And perhaps you look out the window and you see who's there. And depending on who's there, maybe on different days you do the same thing, same scenario, and different people come. And after a while you notice how the different ideations, concerns that come up, the different ways the mind contracts depending on who's there. You know, so, you know, it might be the in-laws. And that produces a certain sense of self, self-image, what you don't want to be, do be, something. Or maybe it's your date. And so, well, you got, you know, then you have to kind of create another kind of self, different kind of self than your in-laws. You know, you have to put on different clothes, right? Probably the clothes you put on for your date are a little bit different than the clothes you put on for your in-laws. So the self-image, how you want to present yourself. Or perhaps it is a neighbor in distress. Or perhaps it's a solicitor wanting you to sell you magazine subscriptions. And, you know, you can go on with the scenario, probably there's other scenarios which are more useful for you to consider, where you can imagine yourself in the process being somehow at ease and peace, no concern about self at all, but in seeing that person, there's a contraction, a narrowing, a preoccupation, a focusing of the mind, the thoughts, the ideations, the self-image that wasn't happening before, but now is happening. That contrast is what's important. Not deciding which is true, but that contrast. And the contrast in Buddhism that's emphasized is one is maybe peaceful and one has lost some of its peace. One is uncomfortable. If the uncomfortable contraction around self-image is standard, it's what we do all the time, we live in that universe, we might not recognize the stress or the tension of it being there. Until we do something like that really takes us out of that world and we can experience ourselves in a radically different way and we see, oh, it doesn't have to be that way. So meditation is one of those ways to do that. Going on meditation retreats can do that even more so. But there's other things. People go backpacking or a variety of things that people can do to help them step out of the particular ideation, self-image that they're caught in. And some of them are not psychological, you know, that we've created, you know, just because of attachment to an ordinary sense of self. Some of the ways that we're contracted or tight or held, limited, maybe limited is a good word, limited by ideas of self, are because we've inherited those ideas of self from our culture. And it's very hard for people to understand how deeply embedded cultural views of self are in our psyche. And we just take it for granted. So, you know, I think most people in the, you know, who have the modern Western acculturation of the individual self will take that idea of an individual self as being, that's the natural order of the universe. That's the way things should be. That's just how it is, right? And it's a relatively modern phenomenon. Anthropologists, sociologists have written about the construction of the modern sense of self and how different it is. People in the Middle Ages, they say, in Europe, would have had a completely foreign idea, this idea of the individual sense of self. Or I read an account recently of young man, I don't know how old he was, 29, 36, something, who went to find his mother he hadn't seen since he was five. He grew up in a place like Philadelphia in the suburbs. And his mother had left him with the father and another sibling when he was five. And the story was that the father was an anthropologist of indigenous native people in the Amazon and had married an indigenous woman from that place who grew up there as, you know, in a tribe that had probably almost never seen anybody from outside of the Amazon. So quite separated from any kind of modern world thing. But somehow they ended up being married, and she moved with him to Philadelphia, to his house in the suburbs, which was, for her eyes, a box where she lived alone. He would go to work, and she was left there in this box. And it was radically different from how she grew up, where apparently in this tribe, this tribe is famous for because apparently anthropologists in the 60s wrote about them as being the most vicious, ferocious, violent group in the Amazon. Apparently it wasn't quite true, but they would, the whole village would live in apparently a very big lodge, the whole tribe, all together under one roof, where they have different fires, cooking fires around that's lodged, you know, each family by himself. And so when you woke up in the morning, you were with the whole village, the whole tribe, and you would fight and make love and do all you do in this place. And so they were kind of, the sense of being community and connected was, you know, being always people there was part of her growing up. So you can imagine how radically different it was to be the individual self in the suburban home in Philadelphia. And so she couldn't manage there. She wasn't able to continue. So she had to go back. She went back to the Amazon and didn't see her son for many years until he decided to go look for her. And different cultural ideas of self. And so we have our own. And I say this not to say that any cultural ideas of self are wrong, but what's very interesting to do something like deep meditation, where even the ordinary cultural ideations, images, ideas that we have of self, which are so deeply ingrained, we don't even think of them as being something we're doing, relax and settle out. It sometimes is called the deconstruction process. Deconstructing, deconstructing, constructing all these ideations, these very, very subtle ways in which we construct ourselves. And a radical experience of just being alive and present, breathing, open, peaceful, with some of the deepest or maybe the deepest constructions, activities of construction in the mind about self and other falling away. Because in that deep, deep place of it falling away, it provides us with an interesting contrast. The contrast between not having any constructs of self and then starting to pick them up again. And that contrast is where wisdom can arise. That contrast is where we can look at the beginning of these constructs and decide, do I really want to be involved in these? Or how do I want to be involved in them? When are they useful? When are they not useful? As opposed to assuming this is how it is. So, some of the constructs we have are useful, and some of them, the very same ones, can be tremendously painful. Someone can be identify themselves with their occupation. And maybe it's an occupation that's useful to, you know, when you have this job, it's useful to have some constructs, some ideas of what it means to be a person who has this job, and that people see you that way, they have certain authority because of this, and all kinds of, you know, it comes with it, certain kinds of ideas of self you have to live by if you have this job, and expect, and you have to take it into account. But if you can't, when you take off your uniform or you go home, if you can't put this down, then you're probably attached to it, kind of been locked on or glued onto it, and you end up acting that way in ways which are not appropriate outside of the work. And we know that some people get so identified with their occupation that when they retire, they get lost. They don't know who they are. The particular occupation might be very useful for society. So it's useful to take on this uniform, this role. But it's also important, if you want to be free, to know how to put it down. So a person who has, like in deep meditation, being able to put it really down, all these things, and really seeing the nature of the constructed self and how it arises and constructed and how we hold on to it, and learn to let go deeply enough, can see that contrast better and then has more room to let go. And so this construct of self that goes on, this contraction or limiting ourselves by an idea, is in ancient time of the Buddha very often described as in the form of doing three things. Seeing things as me, myself, and mine. So mine, this is my thing, thank you. And I'm sure that I could pretty easily get most of you a little bit contracted and focused in a narrow way pretty quickly around the idea of mine. Most of you today here have taken off your shoes. I could sneak out during meditation, gather up all those shoes, and donate them to a good cause. And you'd come out of the meditation hall, my shoes. And you weren't thinking, you don't actively thinking of my shoes all the time while you're meditating, right? I hope you're not. You know, that's not a thought that you're doing, and you're not contracted around my shoes. But as soon as you see them gone, you know, the sense of mine, you know, becomes really strong. So mine, so it's a silly example, but, you know, the idea of mine is one of the places where the mind gets caught and contracted. When I was 17, I traveled around Europe, kind of like a hippie, maybe hippie, with four other people. We had a little commune in a Volkswagen bus, five of us, and we had almost no money. I think I had something like $50, which was a lot of money back then, $50 for my month that I was going to be traveling around Europe. And my friends didn't have much more. So we slept in, you know, on the van, in the van, around the van, under the van, whatever we could. And but we shared everything. Whatever money we had, we kind of shared. Whatever food we bought, we shared. Mostly we bought bread and canned milk, evaporated milk, because that was like a cheap way of keeping going. And then I came back for the last year in high school in Los Angeles, and I hung out with my buddies in high school, and it was kind of the contrast of that sharing and everything and freely, and my friends having no concept of that kind of sharing. It was kind of shocking for me. Like, we'd go out maybe to a hamburger fast food place or something, and one person would say, "Oh, I don't have enough money." And I said, "Oh, it's no problem here. I have. Like, we're all going to share, right?" No, can't do that. And so they say a mind. It's a construct. It's an idea. Or the great kind of story, mythic story that in San Francisco Zen Center of Suzuki Roshi. There's a photograph of him saying this, amazingly enough. So you can see this photograph. He's holding his glasses out like this, away from himself, kind of looking at his glasses. And he's telling the people there, "These are not my glasses. But you know about my old, tired eyes. So you let me wear them. You let me use them." So they were, you know, conventionally they were his glasses. But he wasn't walking around with a kind of caught in the idea of mine. And he had a different, looked at it in a different way. So mine is one of the places we get contracted around some kind of self thing. And then there's myself. And so, I'm pretty confident that all of you at one point or other have been contracted around some idea of who you needed to be, a self. And, you know, as they say that many people are more careful choosing the clothes they wear than the words they speak. And most of a lot of the clothes thing has to do with how we want to present ourselves to people, often, the image we want to make. Are you your hair? No, I'm not my hair. No way. Until the hairdresser, the barber, does this horrible job. I can't go out. No one should see me. Now, all of you I know have outgrown that kind of thing. I'm sure you're all mature, but I have young kids at home, 10 and 15, and in that age range. And guess what? Coming home from the barber, keep going to the mirror and looking, and oh no, can't go to school. So, to identify something as myself, my job, my status, my class, my ethnicity, my gender, my possessions, there's an infinite number of things we can say, this is who I am. And in some ways we are those things. It's not like to say we're not, but the activity of the mind to say, this is who I am, is one of the places the mind gets limited and contracted. It's an activity, it's something we do. Right? You understand? So, then the third activity of selfing, this activity of selfing, is in Pali it's called me, which means here it has to do with having some kind of philosophical religious view about what the core essential essence of who you are is. So the idea of a soul, for example, would be one. And rather than denying that there is a soul, the interesting thing for practitioners is to notice the contraction that happens in the activity of positing a soul or living around a soul or being a soul. For the modern psychological world, where we don't so much look at the soul, but rather the self, the idea of selfing, of having an essential idea of who the self is, can also be a contraction. Or it can be a magnet for all kinds of other ideas of what it means to have a self. Once we posit there is a self, we have to fill in the blank. The self is. And then, our society and everyone will help us. And there's no shortage of suffering in our world around this idea of filling in, this is who I essentially am. From the point of view of the practice, Buddhist practice, it's not to look at the philosophy or the view of what is the soul or the true self, but rather it's to look at the activity of selfing, doing this kind of, what does the mind do? How does the mind latch on? And in particular, are there ways in which the mind gets limited, gets constricted by the activity of selfing? And the movement of freedom in Buddhism, of letting go, of relaxing deeply, is a movement of no longer limiting ourselves through concepts, ideas, and attachments connected to self. We don't necessarily free ourselves from some of these ordinary ideas of self, but we limit ourselves from the contraction and limitation of that. And odd, you know, I don't know if odd, but amazingly enough, the Buddha pointed out that even the feeling, the sense of I am, is a limitation. Even though some people have said just the simple simplicity of I am-ness can feel liberating compared to all the other ideas, but even that is in itself is kind of limiting. And it's possible to see that I am-ness is an activity of the mind too that can be put to rest. And when that's put to rest, then the person who has experienced this is said to have an unlimited mind or an unrestricted mind. And in a few places in the teachings, ancient teachings of the Buddha, such a person is called a great self, a maha-atta. Just like the word Mahatma Gandhi, that's a fast way of saying maha-atta. Great self. It's a title. But so a great self is someone who has no constriction, no limitations connected to a sense of self. So what it means, of course, is that it's better for someone else to say that to you, about you. Let them say it. Because as soon as you say, I'm a great self... you know, you've gotten contracted. You've gotten limited. So there's no room for conceit. No, you know, just you can just be free. So the not self teaching, I think in practice has a lot to do with this not limiting ourselves by ideations, thoughts, feelings, ideas of self, of me, myself, and mine. And rather than thinking that you're supposed to now be this way, let the practice do its work. If you're able to use mindfulness, attention, concentration, stillness, peace, as a way to watch and see how the construction of self happens, how the limitations, the ideas, the activity of selfing occurs, that is where the wisdom happens. That's how the path to freedom arises. We don't leapfrog over into some abstract idea of being no self. It's by seeing through the illusion or seeing through the construction of self that we see the freedom. So the vantage point of peace or ease or calmness that meditation might give, however little it gives, is a very useful vantage point from which to watch the arising of our constructions again. So, you know, if you meditate or if you go for a walk and sit in your window looking out, being at home, looking out the window, having tea, and you find yourself relatively kind of free of your usual self-ideations, notice, take those opportunities to notice how it arises, how it gets born again, how it gets constructed again. And then stop and take a good look at that and see it as a construction, see it as an activity of the mind. And if you see it as an activity of mind instead of something that's inherently, ultimately, universally true, how does that shift your relationship to it? What wisdom is possible within you from watching that happen? So the whole purpose of the not-self teaching in Buddhism is not to irritate you or annoy you, but rather to help you be more peaceful and at ease, to be free. So, thank you.